side 5, gateway, continuing on page 222. I didn't say anything. I had been aware Clara and Sherry were not very friendly and assumed it was because of me. Clara, reading my mind, said, "I've never cared for Scorpios, especially unevolved ones with that awful huge jaw. Never get an intelligent spiritual thought from one of them." Then she said, to be fair, "But she has courage. You have to give her that." "I don't believe I'm up to this argument," I said. "Not an argument, Bob." She leaned over, cradling my head. She smelled sweaty and female, rather nice in some circumstances, but not quite what I wanted right then. "Hey," I said, "whatever became of musk oil?" "What?" "I mean," I said, suddenly realizing something that had been true for quite a while, "you used to wear that perfume a lot. That was the first thing I remember noticing about you." I thought of Francie Herrera's remark about the gateway smell and realized it had been a long time since I had noticed Clara smelling particularly nice. "Honey, Bob, are you trying to start an argument with me?" "Certainly not, but I'm curious. When did you stop wearing it?" She shrugged and didn't answer, unless looking annoyed is an answer. It was enough of an answer for me because I'd told her often enough that I liked the perfume. "So how are you doing with your shrink?" I asked to change the subject. "It didn't seem to be any improvement," Clara said without warmth. "I guess you're feeling pretty rotten with that head. I think I'll go home now." "No, I mean it," I insisted. "I'm curious about your progress." She hadn't told me a word, though I knew she had signed up, and she seemed to spend 2 or 3 hours a day with him, or it. She had elected to try the machine service from the corporation computer, I knew. "Not bad," she said distantly. "Get over your father fixation yet?" I inquired. Clara said, "Bob, did it ever occur to you that you might get some good out of a little help yourself?" "Funny you should say that. Louise Forehand said the very same thing to me the other day." "Not funny. Think about it. See you later." I dropped my head back after she had gone and closed my eyes. Go to a shrink. What did I need with that? All I needed was one lucky find like Sherry's, and all I needed to make that was the guts to sign up for another trip. But that kind of guts for me seemed to be in very short supply. A note on prayer fans. Question. You didn't tell us anything about Hechi prayer fans, and we see more of them than anything else. Professor Hegrime. What do you want me to tell you, Susie? Question. Well, I know what they look like. Sort of like a rolled-up ice cream cone made out of crystal. All different colors of crystal. If you hold one right and press on it with your thumb, it opens up like a fan. Professor Hegrime. That's what I know, too. They've been analyzed, same as fire pearls and the blood diamonds. But don't ask me what they're for. I don't think the Hechi fanned themselves with them, and I don't think they prayed either. That's just what the novelty dealers called them. The Hechi left them all over the place, even when they tidied everything else up. I suppose they had a reason. I don't have a clue what that reason was, but if I ever find out, I'll tell you. End a note on prayer fans. Time was slipping by, or I was destroying it, and the way I began destroying one day was to go to the museum. They had already installed a complete holo set of Sherry's find. I played the disc over 2 or 3 times just to see what $17,550,000 looked like. It mostly looked like irrelevant junk. That was when each piece was displayed on its own. There were about 10 little prayer fans, proving, I guess, that the Hechi liked to include a few art objects, even with a tire repair kit. Or whatever the rest of it was. Things like triangle-bladed screwdrivers with flexible shafts, things like socket wrenches, but made of some soft material, things like electrical test probes, and things like nothing you ever saw before. Spread out item by item, they seemed pretty random, but the way they fit into each other and into the flat nested boxes that made up the set was a marvel of packing economy. $17,550,000, and if I had stayed with Sherry, I could have been one of the shareholders, or one of the corpses. I stopped off at Clara's place and hung around for a while, but she wasn't home. It wasn't her usual time for being shrunk. On the other hand, I had lost track of Clara's usual times. She had found another kid to mother when its parents were busy, a little black girl, maybe 4 years old, who had come up with a mother who was an astrophysicist and a father who was an exobiologist. and what else Clara had found to keep herself busy, I was not sure. I drifted back to my own room, and Louise Forehand peered out of her door and followed me in. "Bob," she said urgently, "do you know anything about a big danger bonus coming up?" I made room for her on the pad. "Me? No. Why would I?" Her pale, muscular face was tauter than ever. I could not tell why. "I thought maybe you'd heard something. From Dane Metchnikoff, maybe. I know you're close to him, and I've seen him talking to Clara in the schoolroom." I didn't respond to that. I wasn't sure what I wanted to say. "There's a rumor that there's a science trip coming up that's pretty hairy, and I'd like to sign on for it." I put my arm around her. "What's the matter, Louise?" "They posted Willa dead." She began to cry. I held her for a while and let her cry it out. I would have comforted her if I had known how, but what comfort was there to give? After a while, I got up and rummaged around in my cupboard, looking for a joint Claire had left there a couple days before. I found it, lighted it, passed it to her. Louise took a long, hard pull and held it for quite a while. Then she puffed out. "She's dead, Bob," she said. She was over crying now, somber but relaxed. Even the muscles around her neck and up and down her spine were tension-free. "She might come back yet, Louise." She shook her head. "Not really. The corporation posted her ship lost. It might come back, maybe. Willa won't be alive in it. Their last stretch of rations would have run out 2 weeks ago." She stared into space for a moment, then sighed and roused herself to take another pull on the joint. "I wish Sess were here," she said, leaning back and stretching. I could feel the play of muscles against the palm of my hand. The dope was hitting her, I could see. I knew it was hitting me. It wasn't any of your usual gateway window box stuff sneaked in among the ivy. Clara had got hold of pure Naples red from one of the cruiser boys, shade grown on the slopes of Mount Vesuvius between the rows of vines that made Lacrimae Christi wine. She turned toward me and snuggled her chin into my neck. "I really love my family," she said calmly enough. "I wish we had hit lucky here. We're about due for some luck." "Hush, honey," I said, nuzzling into her hair. Her hair led to her ear, and her ear led to her lips, and step by step we were making love in a timeless, gentle, stoned way. It was very relaxed. Louise was confident, unanxious, and accepting. After a couple of months of Clara's nervous paroxysms, it was like coming home to Mom's chicken soup. At the end, she smiled, kissed me, and turned away. She was very still, and her breathing was even. She lay silent for a long time, and it wasn't until I realized that my wrist was getting damp that I knew she was crying again. "I'm sorry, Bob," she said when I began to pat her. "It's just that we've never had any luck. Some days I can live with that fact, and some days not. This is one of the bad ones." "You will." "I don't think so. I don't believe it anymore." "You got here, didn't you? That's pretty lucky." She twisted herself around to face me, her eyes scanning mine. I said, "I mean, think of how many billion people would give their left testicles to be here." Louise said slowly, "Bob..." She stopped. I started to speak, but she put her hand over my lips. "Bob," she said, "do you know how we managed to get here?" "Sure. Sess sold his air body." "We sold more than that. The air body brought a little over 100,000. That wasn't enough for even one of us. We got the money from Hat." "Your son? The one that died?" She said, "Hat had a brain tumor. They caught it in time, or anyway, almost in time. It was operable. He could have lived, oh, I don't know, 10 years at least. He would have been messed up some. His speech centers were affected, and so was his muscle control. But he could have been alive right now. Only," she took her hand off my chest to rub it across her face, but she wasn't crying, "he didn't want us to spend the air body money on term medical for him. It would have just about paid for the surgery, and then we would have been broke again. So what he did, he sold himself, Bob. He sold off all his parts, more than just a left testicle, all of him. They were fine, first-quality Nordic male 22-year-old parts, and they were worth a bundle. He signed himself over to the medics, and they, how do you say it, put him to sleep. There must be pieces of Hat in a dozen different people now. They sold off everything for transplants, and they gave us the money. Close to $1 million. Got us here with some despair. So that's where our luck came from, Bob." I said, "I'm sorry." "For what?" We just don't have the luck, Bob. Hat's dead. Willa's dead. God knows where my husband is, or our one last surviving kid. And I'm here, and Bob, half the time I wish with all my heart that I were dead, too. Corporation Report, Orbit 37. 74 vessels returned from launches during this period with a total crew of 216. 20 additional vessels were judged lost with a total crew of 54. In addition, 19 crew members were killed or died of injuries, although the vessels returned. Three returning vessels were damaged past the point of feasible repair. Landing reports. 19. Five of the surveyed planets had life at the microscopic level or higher. One possessed structured plant or animal life, none intelligent. Artifacts. Additional samples of usual Heechee equipment were returned. No artifacts from other sources. No previously unknown Heechee artifacts. Samples. Chemical or mineral, 145. None adjudged of sufficient value to justify exploitation. Living organic, 31. Three of these were judged hazardous and disposed of in space. None found of exploitable value. Science awards in period, $8,754,500. Other cash awards in period, including royalties, $357,856,000. Awards and royalties arising from new discoveries in period, other than science awards, zero. Personnel grounded or existing gateway in period, 151. Lost operationally, 75, including two lost in lander exercises. Medically unfit at end of year, 84. Total losses, 310. New personnel arriving in period, 415. Returned to duty, 66. Total increment during period, 481. Net gain in personnel, 171. End Corporation Report, Orbit 37. I left her sleeping in my bed and wandered down to Central Park. I called Clara, found her out, left a message to say where I was, and spent the next hour or so on my back looking up the mulberries ripening on the tree. There was no one there except for a couple of tourists taking a fast look through before their ship left. I didn't pay attention to them, didn't even hear them leave. I was feeling sorry for Louise and for all the four hands, and even sorrier for myself. They didn't have the luck, but what I didn't have hurt a lot more. I didn't have the courage to see where my luck would take me. Six societies squeeze adventurers out like grape pips. The grape pips don't have much to say about it. I suppose it was the same with Columbus's seamen or the pioneers manhandling their covered wagons through Comanche territory. They must have been scared witless like me, but they didn't have much choice. Like me, but God, how frightened I was. I heard voices, a child's, and a light, slower laugh that was Clara's. I sat up. "Hello, Bob," she said, standing before me with her hand on the head of a tiny black girl in cornrow hair. "This is Waddy." "Hello, Waddy." My voice didn't sound right, even to me. Clara took a closer look and demanded, "What's the matter?" I couldn't answer that question in one sentence, so I chose one facet. Willa Forehand's been posted dead. Clara nodded without saying anything. Waddy piped, "Please, Clara, throw the ball." Clara tossed it to her, caught it, tossed it again, all in the gateway adagio. I said, "Louise wants to go on a danger bonus launch. I think what she wants is for me, for us, to go and take her with us." "Oh? Well, what about it? Has Dane said anything to you about one of his specials?" "No. I haven't seen Dane for, I don't know. Anyway, he shipped out this morning on a one." "He didn't have a farewell party," I protested, surprised. She pursed her lips. The little girl called, "Hey, mister, catch." When she threw the ball, it came floating up like a hot air balloon to a mooring mast. But even so, I almost missed it. My mind was on something else. I tossed it back with concentration. After a minute, Clara said, "Bob, I'm sorry. I guess I was in a bad mood." "Yeah, my mind was very busy." She said placatingly, "We've been having some hard times, Bob. I don't want to be raspy with you. I brought you something." I looked around and she took my hand and slid something up over it, onto my arm. It was a launch bracelet, Heechee metal, worth $500 anywhere. I hadn't been able to afford to buy one. I stared at it, trying to think of what I wanted to say. Bob? What? There was an edge to her voice. It's customary to say thank you. It's customary, I said, to give a truthful answer to a question, like not saying you hadn't seen Dane Metchnikoff when you were with him just last night. She flared. You've been spying on me. You've been lying to me. Bob, you don't own me. Dane's a human being and a friend. Friend, I barked. The last thing Metchnikoff was to anyone was a friend. Just thinking about Clara with him made my groin crawl. I didn't like the sensation because I couldn't identify it. It wasn't just anger. It wasn't even just jealousy. There was a component that it remained obstinately opaque. I said, knowing it was illogical, hearing myself seem almost a whine, I introduced you to him. That doesn't give you ownership, all right? Clara snarled. Maybe I went to bed with him a few times. It doesn't change how I feel about you. It changes how I feel about you, Clara. She stared incredulously. You have the nerve to say that? Coming here, smelling of sex with some cheap floozy? That one caught me off guard. There was nothing cheap about it. I was comforting someone in pain. She laughed. The sound was unpleasant. Anger is unbecoming. Louise Forehand, she hustled her way up here. Did you know that? The little girl was holding the ball and staring at us now. I could see we were frightening her. I said, trying to tighten my voice to keep the anger from spilling out. Clara, I'm not going to let you make a fool out of me. Ah, she said in inarticulate disgust and turned around to go. I reached out to touch her and she sobbed and hit me as hard as she could. The blow caught me on the shoulder. That was a mistake. That's always a mistake. It isn't a matter of what's rational or justified. It is a matter of signals. It was the wrong signal to give me. The reason wolves don't kill each other off is that the smaller and weaker wolf always surrenders. It rolls over, bares its throat, and puts its paws in the air to signal that it is beaten. When that happens, the winner is physically unable to attack any more. If it were not that way, there wouldn't be any wolves left. For the same reason, men don't usually kill women, or not by beating them to death. They can't, however much he wants to hit her. His internal machinery vetoes it. But if the woman makes the mistake of giving him a different signal by hitting him first... I punched her 4 or 5 times as hard as I could, on the breast, in the face, in the belly. She fell to the ground sobbing. I knelt beside her, lifted her up with one hand, and, in absolutely cold blood, slapped her twice more. It was all happening as if choreographed by God, absolutely inevitably. And at the same time, I could feel that I was breathing as hard as though I'd climbed a mountain on a dead run. The blood was thundering in my ears. Everything I saw was hazed with red. I finally heard a distant, thin crying. I looked and saw the little girl, Wadi, staring at me, her mouth open, tears rolling down her wide, purplish-black cheeks. I started to move toward her to reassure her. She screamed and ran behind a grape trellis. I turned back toward Clara, who was sitting up, not looking at me, her hand cupped over her mouth. She took the hand away and stared at something in it, a tooth. I didn't say anything. I didn't know what to say and didn't trust myself to think of anything. I turned and left. I don't remember what I did for the next few hours. I didn't sleep, although I was physically exhausted. I sat on the chest of drawers in my room for a while. Then I left it again. I remember talking to somebody, I think it was a straggling tourist off the Venus ship, about how adventurous and exciting prospecting was. I remember eating something in the commissary. And all the time I was thinking, I wanted to kill Clara. I had been containing all that stored up fury, and I hadn't even let myself know it was there until she pulled the trigger. I didn't know if she would ever forgive me. I wasn't sure she ought to, and I wasn't even sure that I wanted her to. I could not imagine our ever being lovers again, but what I finally was sure I wanted was to apologize. Only she wasn't in her rooms. There was no one there but a plump young black woman slowly sorting out clothes with a tragic face. When I asked after Clara, she began to cry. She's gone, the woman sobbed. Gone? Oh, she looked awful. Someone must have beaten her up. She brought Wadi back and said she wouldn't be able to take care of her anymore. She gave me all her clothes, but what am I going to do with Wadi when I'm working? Gone where? The woman lifted her head. Back to Venus, on the ship. It left an hour ago. I didn't talk to anyone else. Alone in my own bed, somehow I got to sleep. When I got up, I gathered together everything I owned. My clothes, my holodisks, my chess set, my wristwatch. The Hichi bracelet that Clara had given me. I went around and sold them off. I cleaned out my credit account and put all the money together. It came to a total of $1,400 and change. I took the money up to the casino and put it all on number 31 on the roulette wheel. The big slow ball drifted into a socket. Green. Zero. I went down to Mission Control and signed for the first one that was available, and 24 hours later I was in space. Classifieds. I need your courage to go for any half mil plus bonus. Don't ask me. Order me. 87-299. Public auction, unclaimed personal effects non-returnees. Corporation area, Charlie 9, 1300 to 1700 tomorrow. Your debts are paid when you achieve oneness. He, she is he, she, and he, she forgives. Church of the Marvelously Maintained Motorcycle, 88-344. Monosexuals only for mutual sympathy only. No touching, 87-913. End classifieds. Chapter 23. How do you really feel about Dane, Bob? How the hell do you think I feel? He seduced my girl. That's a strangely old-fashioned way to put it, Bob, but it happened an awfully long time ago. Sure it did. Siegfried strikes me as being unfair. He sets up rules, then he doesn't play by them. I say indignantly, cut it out, Siegfried. All that happened a long time ago, but it isn't being a long time ago for me, because I've never let it come out. It's still brand new inside my head. Isn't that what you're supposed to do for me? Let all that old stuff inside my head come out so it can dry up and blow away and not cripple me anymore? I'd still like to know why it stays so brand new inside your head, Bob. Oh, Christ, Siegfried. This is one of Siegfried's stupid times. He can't handle some complex kinds of input, I guess. When you come right down to it, he's only a machine and can't do anything he isn't programmed to do. Mostly, he just responds to key words. Well, with a little attention to meaning, sure. And to nuance, as far as it's expressed by voice tone or by what the sensors in the pad and straps tell him about my muscle activity. If you were a person instead of a machine, you'd understand, I tell him. Perhaps so, Bob. To get him back on the right track, I say, it is true that it happened a long time ago. I don't see what you're asking beyond that. I'm asking you to resolve a contradiction I perceive in what you say. You've been saying that you don't mind the fact that your girlfriend Clara had sexual relations with other men. Why is it so important that she did with Dane? Dane didn't treat her right. And good God, he certainly didn't. He left her stuck like a fly in amber. Is it because of how he treated Clara, Bob? Or is it something between Dane and you? Never. There was never anything between Dane and me. You did tell me he was bi, Bob. What about the flight you took with him? He had two other men to play with. Not me, boy, no. I swear, not me. Oh, I say, trying to calm my voice enough to make it reflect the very mild interest I really felt in this stupid subject. To be sure, he tried to put the make on me once or twice, but I told him it wasn't my style. Your voice, Bob, he says, seems to reflect more anger than your words account for. Damn you, Siegfried. I really am angry now. I admit it. I can hardly get the words out. You get me pissed off with your wild accusations. Sure, I'll let him put his arm around me once or twice. That's as far as I went. Nothing serious. I was just abusing myself to make the time pass. I liked him well enough. Big, good-looking fellow. You get lonesome when... Now what? Siegfried is making a sound, sort of like clearing one's throat. It is how he interrupts without interrupting. What did you just say, Bob? What? When? When you said there was nothing serious between you. Christ, I don't know what I said. There was nothing serious, that's all. I was just entertaining myself to make the time pass. You didn't use the word entertaining, Bob. I didn't? What word did I use? I reflect, listening for the echo of my own voice. I guess I said amusing myself. What about it? You didn't say amusing either, Bob. What did you say? I don't know. You said, I was just abusing myself. Bob. My defenses go up. I feel as though I had suddenly discovered I'd wet my pants or that my fly was open. I step outside my body and look at my own head. What does abusing myself mean to you, Bob? Say, I say, laughing, genuinely impressed and amused at the same time. That's a real Freudian slip, isn't it? You fellows are pretty keen. My compliments to the programmers. Siegfried doesn't respond to my urbane comment. He just lets me stew in it for a minute. All right, I say. I feel very open and vulnerable, letting nothing at all happen, living in that moment as though it were lasting forever, like Clara, stuck in her instant and eternal fall. Siegfried says gently, Bob, when you masturbated, did you ever have fantasies about Dane? I hated it, I say. He waits. I hated myself for it. I mean, not hated, exactly. More like despised. Poor goddamn son of a bitch. Me all kinky and awful, beating his meat and thinking about being screwed by his girl's lover. Siegfried waits me out for a while. Then he says, I think you really want to cry, Bob. He's right, but I don't say anything. Would you like to cry? He invites. I'd love it, I say. Then why don't you go ahead and cry, Bob? I wish I could, I say. Unfortunately, I just don't know how. A note on metallurgy. Question. I saw a report that Heechee metal had been analyzed by the National Bureau of Standards. Professor Hegreme. No, you didn't, Tetsu. Question. But it was on the PV. Professor Hegreme. No, you saw a report that the Bureau of Standards had issued a quantitative assessment of Heechee metal, not an analysis. Just a description. Tensile strength, fracture strength, melting point, all that stuff. Question. I'm not sure I understand the difference. Professor Hegreme. No, you didn't, Tetsu. We know exactly what it does. We don't yet know what it is. What's the most interesting thing about Heechee metal? You, Terry. Question. It glows? Professor Hegreme. It glows, yes. It emits light. Bright enough so that we don't need anything else to light our rooms. We have to cover it over when we want dark. And it's been glowing for 500,000 years at least like that. Where does the energy come from? The Bureau says there are some post-uranic elements in it, and probably they drive the radiation, but we don't know what they are. There's also something in it that looks like an isotope of copper. Well, copper doesn't have any stable isotopes, up to now. So what the Bureau says is what the exact frequency of the blue light is and all the physical measurements to 8 or 9 decibels. But the report doesn't tell you how to make any. End a note on metallurgy. A note on Heechee habitat. Question. Don't we even know what a Heechee table or any old housekeeping thing looks like? Professor Hegreme. We don't even know what a Heechee house looks like. We never found one, just tunnels. They're like branching shafts, with rooms opening out of them. They're like big chambers, shaped like spindles, tapered at both ends, too. There's one here, two on Venus, probably the remains of one that's half eroded away on Peggy's world. Question. I know what the bonus is for, finding intelligent alien life, but what's the bonus for finding a Heechee? Professor Hegreme. Just find one. Then name your price. End a note on Heechee habitat. Chapter 24. I was just turning over, making up my mind to go to sleep, when I noticed that the colors on the Heechee guidance system were breaking up. It was the 55th day of my trip, the 27th since turnover. The colors had been shocking pink for the whole 55 days. Now whorls of pure white formed, grew, clotted together. I was arriving. Wherever it was going to turn out to be when I got there, I was arriving. My little old ship, the smelly, hurtful, tedious coffin I had been banging around in for nearly 2 months by myself, talking to myself, playing games with myself, tired of myself, was well below light speed. I leaned over to look at the view screen, now relatively down to me because I had been decelerating, and saw nothing that looked very exciting. Oh, there was a star, yes. There were lots of stars in a scattering of groupings that in no way looked familiar. Half a dozen blues ranging from bright to hurt the eyes. A red one that stood out more for intensity of hue than luminosity. It was an angry-looking red coal, not much brighter than Mars is from Earth, but a deeper, uglier red. I made myself take an interest. That was not really easy. After 2 months of rejecting everything around me because it was boring or threatening, it was hard for me to switch over to a welcoming, vulnerable mode. I switched on the spherical scan and peered out as the ship began to rotate in its scanning pattern, slicing orange peel strips of sky to capture in the cameras and analyzers. And almost at once, I got a huge, bright, nearby signal return. 55 days of boredom and exhaustion went right out of my mind. There was something either very big or very close. I forgot about being sleepy. I crouched over the view screen, holding on with hands and knees, and then I saw it. A squared-off object marching into the screen, glowing all over, pure heechy metal. It was irregularly slab-sided with rounded pimples studding one of the flat sides. And the adrenaline began to flow, and visions of sugar plums danced in my head. I watched it out of sight, and then hauled myself over to the scan analyzer, waiting to see what would come out. There was no question that it was good. The only question was how good. Maybe extraordinarily good. Maybe a whole Peggy's world all my own, with a royalty in the millions of dollars every year all the rest of my life. Maybe only a vacant shell. Maybe the squared-off shape suggested it. Maybe that wildest of dreams, a whole big heechy ship that I could enter into and fly around anywhere I chose, big enough to carry 1,000 people and 1,000,000 tons of cargo. All those dreams were possible, and even if they all failed, if it was just an abandoned shell, all that it needed was one thing inside it, one little doodad, one gadget, one woozy that nobody had ever found before that could be taken apart and reproduced and made to work on Earth. I stumbled and raked my knuckles against the spiral gadget, now glowing soft gold. I sucked the blood off them and realized the ship was moving. It shouldn't have been moving. It wasn't programmed to do that. It was meant to hang in whatever orbit it was programmed to find and just stay there until I looked around and made my decisions. I stared around, confused and baffled. The glowing slab was firmly in the middle of the view screen now, and it stayed there. The ship had stopped its automatic spherical scan. Belatedly, I heard the distant high yell of the lander motors. They were what was moving me. My ship was targeted for that slab. And a green light was glowing over the pilot's seat. That was wrong. The green light was installed on Gateway by human beings. It had nothing to do with the Heechi. It was the plain old people's radio circuit announcing that someone was calling me. Who? Who could be anywhere near my brand new discovery? I thumbed on the TBS circuit and shouted, "Hello?" There was an answer. I didn't understand it. It seemed to be in some foreign language, perhaps Chinese, but it was human, all right. "Talk English," I yelled. "Who the hell are you?" Pause, then another voice. "Who are you?" "My name is Bob Broadhead," I snarled. "Broadhead?" Confused mumbling of a couple of voices, then the English-speaking voice again. "We don't have any record of a prospector named Broadhead. Are you from Aphrodite?" "What's Aphrodite?" "Oh, Christ, who are you? Listen, this is Gateway 2 Control, and we don't have time to screw around. Identify yourself." "Gateway 2? I snapped off the radio and lay back, watching the slab grow larger, ignoring the demand of the green light. "Gateway 2? How ridiculous. If I had wanted to go to Gateway 2, I would have signed up in the regular course and accepted the penalty of paying royalties on anything I might find. I would have flown out secure as any tourist on a course that had been tested 100 times. I hadn't done that. I had picked a setting no one else had ever used and taken my risks, and I had felt every one of them scared out of my brain for 55 bad days. It wasn't fair. I lost my head. I lunged towards the Heechi course director and shoved the wheels around at random. It was a failure I couldn't accept. I was braced to find nothing. I was not braced to find I had done something easy for no reward at all. But what I produced was a bigger failure still. There was a bright yellow flash from the course board, and then all the colors went black. The thin scream from the lander motor stopped. The feeling of motion was gone. The ship was dead. Nothing was moving. Nothing worked in the Heechi complex. Nothing. Not even the cooling system. By the time Gateway 2 sent a ship out to haul me in, I was delirious with heat stroke in an ambient temperature of 75 degrees Celsius. Gateway was hot and dank. Gateway 2 was cold enough that I had to borrow jacket, gloves, and heavy underwear. Gateway stank of sweat and sewers. Gateway 2 tasted of rusty steel. Gateway was bright and loud and full of people. On Gateway 2, there was almost no sound, and only 7 human beings, not counting myself, to make any. The Heechee had left Gateway 2 not quite completed. Some of the tunnels ended in bare rock, and there were only a few dozen of them. No one had got around to planting vegetation yet, and all the air there was came from chemical processors. The partial pressure of O2 was under 150 millibars, and the rest of the atmosphere was a nitrogen-helium mix, not much more than half Earth normal pressure altogether, that made the voices high-pitched and left me gasping for the first few hours. The man who helped me out of my lander and bundled me up against the sudden cold was a dark, immense Martian Japanese named Norio Ituno. He put me in his own bed, filled me with liquids, and let me rest for an hour. I dozed, and when I woke up, he was sitting there, looking at me with amusement and respect. The respect was for someone who had slain a $500 million ship. The amusement was that I was idiot enough to do it. "I guess I'm in trouble," I said. "I would say so, yes," he agreed. "The ship is totally dead. Never saw anything like it before." I didn't know a Heechee ship could go dead like that. He shrugged. "You did something original, Broadhead. How are you feeling?" I sat up to answer him, and he nodded. "We're pretty busy right now. I'm going to have to let you take care of yourself for a couple of hours, if you can. Fine? Then we'll have a party for you." Party? It was the farthest thing from my mind. For what? "We don't meet someone like you every day, Broadhead," he said admiringly, and left me to my thoughts. I didn't like my thoughts very much, and after a while I got up, put on the gloves, buttoned up the jacket, and started exploring. It didn't take long. There wasn't much there. I heard sounds of activity from the lower levels, but the echoes travel at queer angles along the empty corridors, and I saw no one. Gateway 2 didn't have a tourist trade, and so there wasn't any nightclub or casino, no restaurant that I could find, not even a latrine. After a little while, that question began to seem urgent. I reasoned that Ituno would have to have something like that near his room, and tried to retrace my steps to there, but that didn't work either. There were cubicles along some of the corridors, but they were unfinished. No one lived there, and no one had troubled to install plumbing. It was not one of my better days. When I finally found a toilet, I puzzled over it for 10 minutes, and would guiltily have left it impolitely soiled if I had not heard a sound outside the cubicle. A plump little woman was standing there waiting. "I don't know how to flush it," I apologized. She looked me up and down. "You're Broadhead," she stated, and then, "Why don't you go to Aphrodite?" "What's Aphrodite?" "No, wait. First, how do you flush this thing? Then, what's Aphrodite?" She pointed to a button on the edge of the door. I had thought it was a light switch. When I touched it, the whole bottom of the seamless bowl began to glow, and in 10 seconds there was nothing inside but ash. Then nothing at all. "Wait for me," she commanded, disappearing inside. When she came out, she said, "Aphrodite is where the money is, Broadhead. You're going to need it." I let her take my arm and pull me along. Aphrodite, I began to understand, was a planet, a new one, that a ship from Gateway 2 had opened up less than 40 days earlier, and a big one. "You'd have to pay royalty, of course," she said, "and so far they haven't found anything big, just the usual Heechee debris. But there's thousands of square miles to explore, and it'll be months before the first batch of prospectors starts coming out from Gateway. We only sent the word back 40 days ago. Have you had any hot planet experience?" "Hot planet experience?" "I mean," she explained, pulling me down a drop shaft and calling up to me, "have you ever explored a planet that's hot?" "No, as a matter of fact, I haven't had any experience at all that counts for anything. One trip, empty. I didn't even land." "Pity," she said. "Still, there's not that much to learn. You know what Venus is like. Aphrodite is just a little bit worse. The primary is a flare star, and you don't want to be caught in the open. But the Heechee digs are all underground. If you find one, you're in." "What are the chances of finding one?" I asked. "Well," she said thoughtfully, pulling me off the cable and down a tunnel, "not all that good, maybe. After all, you're out in the open when you're prospecting. On Venus, they use armored air bodies, and they zap around anywhere they want to go, no trouble." "Well, maybe a little trouble," she conceded. "But they don't lose very many prospectors anymore. Maybe 1%. "What percent do you lose on Aphrodite?" More than that. Yes, I grant you, it's higher than that. You have to use the lander from your ship, and of course it's not very mobile on the surface of a planet, especially a planet with a surface like molten sulfur and winds like hurricanes when they're mild. It sounds charming, I said. Why aren't you out there now? Me? I'm an out pilot. I'm going back to Gateway in about 10 days, as soon as I get a cargo loaded or somebody comes in and wants a ride back. I want a ride back right now. Now, oh, cripes, Broadhead, don't you know what kind of trouble you're in? You broke regulations by messing with the control board. They'll throw the book at you. I thought it over carefully. Then I said, thanks, but I think I'll take my chances. Don't you understand? Aphrodite has guaranteed Hichi remains. You could take 100 trips without finding anything like this. Sweetie, I said, I couldn't take 100 trips for anything. Not now and not ever. I don't know if I can take one. I think I have the guts to get back to Gateway. Beyond that, I don't know. Mission report. Vessel 3-104. Voyage 031-D18. Crew N. Ahoya, T.S. Zakarzenko, L. Marks. Transit time 119 days, 4 hours. Position not identified. Apparently outside galactic cluster in dust cloud. Identification of external galaxies doubtful. Summary: we found no trace of any planet, artifact, or landable asteroid within scanning distance. Nearest star approximately 1.7 light years. Conjecture, whatever was there, has since been destroyed. Life support systems began to malfunction on return trip, and Larry Marks died. End mission report. Letter. Dear Voice of Gateway, are you a reasonable and open-minded person? Then prove it by reading this letter all the way through to the end before making up your mind about what it says. There are 13 occupied levels in Gateway. There are 13 residences in each of 13, count them yourself, of the housing halls. Do you think this letter is just silly superstition? Then look at the evidence for yourself. Launches 83-20, 84-1, and 84-10, what do the digits add up to, were all declared overdue in list 86-13. Gateway Corporation, wake up. Let the skeptics and bigots jeer. Human lives depend on your willingness to risk a little ridicule. It would cost nothing to omit the danger numbers from all programs, except courage. M. Gloiner, 88-331. End letter. I was on Gateway 2 altogether 13 days. Hester Bergowitz, the out pilot, kept trying to talk me into going to Aphrodite, I guess because she didn't want me taking up valuable cargo space on her return flight. The others didn't care. They only thought I was crazy. I was a problem for Artuno, who was loosely in charge of keeping things straight on 2. Technically, I was an illegal entrant without a dime's worth of per capita paid and with nothing to pay it with. He would have been within his rights to toss me out into space without a suit. He solved it by putting me to work loading low-priority cargo into Hester's 5, mostly prayer fans and samples for analysis from Aphrodite. That took 2 days, and then he designated me chief gopher for the next 3 people who were rebuilding suits for the next batch of explorers of Aphrodite. They had to use Hichi torches to soften the metal enough to bend it onto the suits, and I wasn't trusted with any of that. It takes 2 years to train a person to handle a Hichi torch in close quarters, but I was allowed to muscle the suits and sheets of Hichi metal into position for them, to fetch tools, to go for coffee, and to put the suits on when they were finished and exit into space to make sure they didn't leak. None of them leaked. On the 12th day, 2 5s came in from Gateway loaded with happy, eager prospectors bringing all the wrong equipment. The word about Aphrodite had not had time to get to Gateway and back, so the new fish didn't know what goodies were in store. Just by accident, one of them was a young girl on a science mission, a former student of Professor Hegremay's, who was supposed to make anthropometric studies of Gateway 2. On his own authority, Norio Ituno reassigned her to Aphrodite and decreed a combination welcome and farewell party. The 10 newcomers and I outnumbered our hosts, but what they lacked in numbers, they made up in drinking, and it was a good party. I found myself a celebrity, The new fish couldn't get over the fact that I had slain a Hichi ship and survived. I was almost sorry to leave, not counting being scared. Ituno splashed 3 fingers of rice whiskey into a glass for me and offered me a toast. "Sorry to see you go, Broadhead," he said. "Sure you won't change your mind?" "We've got more armored ships and suits than we have prospectors right now, but I don't know how long that's going to last. If you change your mind after you get back..." "I'm not going to change my mind," I said. "Banzai," he said, and drank. "Listen, do you know an old guy named Bakin?" "Shiki?" "Sure, my neighbor. Give him my regards," he said, pouring another drink for the purpose. "He's a great guy, but he reminds me of you. I was with him when he lost his legs. Got caught in the lander when we had to jettison. Damn near died. By the time we got him to Gateway, he was all swelled up and smelled like hell. We had to take the legs off 2 days out. I did it myself." "He's a great person, all right," I said absently, finishing the drink and holding the glass out for more. "Hey, what do you mean he reminds you of me?" "Can't make up his mind, Broadhead. He's got a stake that's enough to put him on full medical, and he can't make up his mind to spend it. If he spends it, he can have his legs back and go out again, but then he'd be broke if he didn't score. So he just stays on, a cripple." I put the glass down. I didn't want any more to drink. "So long, Ituno," I said. "I'm going to bed." Song. We sniff for your scent in the gas of Orion. We dig for your den with the dogs of Procyon. From Baltimore, Buffalo, Bon, and Benares, we seek you around Algo, Arcturus, Antares. We'll find you someday, little lost Hichi. We're on our way. End of song. I spent most of the trip back writing letters to Clara that I didn't know if I would ever mail. There wasn't much else to do. Hester turned out to be surprisingly sexual for a small, plump lady of a certain age, but there's a limit to how long that is entertaining, and with all the cargo we had jammed in the ship, there wasn't room for much else. The days were all the same. Sex, letter writing, sleeping, and worrying. Worrying about why Shiki Bakin wanted to stay a cripple, which was a way of worrying, in a way I could face, about why I did. Classifieds. Shade-grown broadleaf, hand-tended and rolled. $2 roach, 87-307. Present whereabouts. Augusto T. Agnelli. Call Corporation Security for Interpol. Reward. Stories, poems published. Perfect way to preserve memories for your children. Surprisingly low cost. Publisher's Rep, 87-349. Anybody from Pittsburgh or Paducah? I'm homesick. 88-226. End of classifieds. Chapter 25. Siegfried says, "You sound tired, Bob." Well, that was understandable enough. I'd gone off to Hawaii for the weekend. Some of my money was in tourism there, so it was all tax deductible. It was a lovely couple of days on the Big Island, with a 2-hour stockholders meeting in the morning and afternoons with one of those beautiful island girls on the beach, or sailing in glass-bottomed catamarans, watching the big mantas glide underneath, begging for crumbs. But coming back, you fight time zones all the way, and I was exhausted. Only that is not the sort of thing that Siegfried really wants to hear about. He doesn't care if you're physically exhausted. He doesn't care if you've got a broken leg. He only wants to know if you dream about screwing your mother. I say that. I say, "I'm tired, all right, Siegfried, but why don't you stop making small talk? Get right into my Oedipal feelings about Ma." "Did you have any, Bobby?" "Doesn't everybody?" "Do you want to talk about them, Bobby?" "Not particularly." He waits, and I wait, too. Siegfried has been being cute again, and now his room is fixed up like a boy's room from 40 years ago. Crossed ping-pong paddles hologrammed on the wall. A fake window with a fake view of the Montana Rockies in a snowstorm. A hologrammed cassette shelf of boys' stories on tape, Tom Sawyer and Lost Race of Mars, and I can't read the rest of the titles. It is all very homey, but not in the least like my own room as a boy, which was tiny, narrow, and almost filled by the old sofa I slept on. "Do you know what you want to talk about, Rob?" Siegfried probes gently. "You bet. Then I reconsider. Well, no, I'm not sure. Actually, I do know. Something had hit me on the way back from Hawaii, very hard. It's a 5-hour flight. Half the time I had spent drenched in tears. It was funny. There was this lovely, happy Haole girl flying east in the seat next to me, and I decided right away to get to know her better. And the stewardess was the same one I'd had before, and she I already knew better. So there I was, sitting at the very back of the first-class section of the SST, taking drinks from the stewardess, chatting with my pretty, happy Haole. And every time the girl was drowsing, or in the ladies' room, and the stewardess was looking the other way, racked with silent, immense, tearful sobs. And then one of them would look my way again, and I would be smiling, alert, and on the make. Do you want to just say what you're feeling at this second, Bob? I would in a minute, Siegfried, if I knew what it was. Don't you know, really? Can't you remember what was in your head while you weren't talking just now? Sure I can. I hesitate, then I say, oh hell, Siegfried, I guess I was just waiting to be coaxed. I had an insight the other day and it hurt. Oh, wow. You wouldn't believe how it hurt. I was crying like a baby. What was the inside, Bobby? I'm trying to tell you. It was about, well, it was partly about my mother. But it was also about, well, you know, Dane Metchnikoff. I think you're trying to say something about the fantasies you had of having anal sex with Dane Metchnikoff, Bob. Is that right? Yeah. You remember good, Siegfried. When I was crying, it was about my mother. Partly, you told me that, Bob. Right. And I close up. Siegfried waits. I wait, too. I suppose I want to be coaxed some more. And after a while, Siegfried obliges me. Let's see if I can help you, Bob, he says. What do crying about your mother and your fantasies about anal sex with Dane have to do with each other? I feel something happening inside of me. It feels as though the soft, wet inside of my chest is starting to bubble into my throat. I can tell that when my voice comes out, it is going to be tremulous and desperately forlorn if I don't control it. So I try to control it, although I know perfectly well that I have no secrets of this sort from Siegfried. He can read his sensors and know what is going on inside me from the tremble of a triceps or the dampness of a palm. But I make the effort anyway. In the tones of a biology instructor explaining a prepared frog, I say, see, Siegfried, my mother loved me. I knew it. You know it. It was a logical demonstration. She had no choice. And Freud said once that no boy who was certain he was his mother's favorite ever grows up to be neurotic. Only, please, Robbie, that isn't quite right. And besides, you're intellectualizing. You know you really don't want to put in all these preambles. You're stalling, aren't you? Other times I would tear the circuits out of his chips for that. But this time he has my mood gauged correctly. All right, but I did know that my mother loved me. She couldn't help it. I was her only son. My father was dead. Don't clear your throat, Siegfried. I'm getting to it. It was a logical necessity that she loved me. And I understood it that way with no doubt at all in my mind. But she never said so. Never once. You mean that never in your whole life did she say to you, I love you, son? No, I scream. Then I get control again. Or not directly, no. I mean once when I was like 18 years old and going to sleep in the next room, I heard her say to one of her friends, girlfriends I mean, that she really thought I was a tremendous kid. She was proud of me. I don't remember what I'd done, something, won a prize or got a job, but she right that minute was proud of me and loved me and said so, but not to me. Please go on, Bob, Siegfried says after a moment. I am going on. Give me a minute. It hurts. I guess it's what you call primal pain. Please don't diagnose yourself, Bob. Just say it. Let it come out. Oh, shit. I reach for a cigarette and then stop the motion. That's usually a good thing to do when things get tight with Siegfried, because it will almost always distract him into an argument about whether I'm trying to relieve tension instead of dealing with it. But this time I am too disgusted with myself, with Siegfried, even with my mother. I want to get it over with. I say, look, Siegfried, here's how it was. I loved my mother a lot, and I knew, she loved me, but she wasn't very good at showing it. I suddenly realize I have a cigarette in my hands, and I'm rolling it around without lighting it, and wondrous to say, Siegfried hasn't even commented on it. I plunge right on. She didn't say the words to me. Not only that, it's funny, Siegfried, but, you know, I can't remember her ever touching me. I mean, not really. She would kiss me goodnight sometimes, on the top of the head. And I remember she told me stories, and she was always there when I needed her. But, I have to stop for a moment to get control of my voice again. I inhale deeply and evenly through my nose, concentrating on breath flow. But you see, Siegfried, I say, rehearsing the words ahead of time, pleased with the clarity and balance with which I deliver them, she didn't touch me much, except for one way. She was very good to me when I was sick. I was sick a lot. Everybody around the food mines has runny noses, skin infections, you know. She got me everything I needed. She was there, God knows how, holding down a job and taking care of me all at once. And when I was sick, she... After a moment, Siegfried says, "Go on, Robbie, say it." I try, but I am still stuck, and he says, "Just say it the fastest way you can. Get it out. Don't worry if I understand or if it makes sense. Just get rid of the words." "Well, she would take my temperature," I explain. "You know, stick a thermometer into me, and she'd hold me for, you know, whatever it is, 3 minutes or so, and then she'd take the thermometer out and read it." I'm right on the verge of bawling. I'm willing to let it happen, but first I want to follow this thing through. It is almost a sexual thing, like when you are getting right up to the moment of decision with some person, and you don't think you really want to let her be that much a part of you, but you go ahead anyhow. I save up voice control, measuring it out so that I won't run out before I finish. Siegfried doesn't say anything, and after a moment I manage the words. "You see how it is, Siegfried? It's funny. All my life now, what is it, maybe 40 years since then? And I still have this crazy notion that being loved has something to do with having things stuck up my ass." Mission Report. Vessel A3-77. Voyage 036D51. Crew T. Pereno, N. Ahoya, E. Nimkin. Transit time 5 days, 14 hours. Position vicinity Alpha Centauri A. Summary. The planet was quite Earth-like and heavily vegetated. The color of the vegetation was predominantly yellow. The atmosphere matched the Heechee mix closely. It is a warm planet with no polar ice caps and a temperate range similar to Earth tropics at the equator, Earth temperate extending almost to the poles. We detected no animal life or signatures, methane, etc., thereof. Some of the vegetation predates at a very slow pace, advancing by uprooting portions of a vine-like structure, curling around and rerooting. Maximum velocity measured was approximately 2 kilometers per hour. No artifacts. Pereno and Nimkin landed and returned with samples of vegetation, but died of a toxicodendron-like reaction. Great blisters formed over their bodies. Then they developed pain, itching, and apparent suffocation, probably due to fluids accumulating in the lung. I did not bring them aboard the vessel. I did not open the lander or dock it to the vessel. I recorded personal messages for both, then jettisoned the lander and returned without it. Corporation assessment, no charge made against N. Ahoya in view of past record. End mission report. Chapter 26. There had been a lot of changes on Gateway while I was out. The head tax had been raised. The corporation wanted to get rid of some of the extra hangers-on, like Shiki and me. Bad news. It meant that my prepaid per capita wasn't good for 2 or 3 weeks. It was only good for 10 days. They had imported a bunch of double domes from Earth. Astronomers, xenotechs, mathematicians. Even old Professor Hegrame was up from Earth, bruised from the liftoff deltas, but hopping spryly around the tunnels. One thing that hadn't changed was the evaluation board, and I was impaled on the hot seat in front of it, squirming while my old friend Emma told me what a fool I was. Mr. Sheehan was actually doing the telling. Emma only translated, but she loved her work. "I warned you, you'd fuck up, Broadhead. You should have listened to me. Why did you change the setting?" "I told you. When I found out I was at Gateway 2, I just couldn't handle it. I wanted to go somewhere else." "Extraordinarily stupid of you, Broadhead." I glanced at Sheehan. He had hung himself up on the wall by his rolled-up collar and was hanging there, beaming benignly, hands folded. "Emma," I said, "do whatever you want to do, but get off my back." She said sunnily, "I am doing what I want to do, Broadhead, because it's what I have to do. It's my job. You knew it was against the rules to change the settings." "What rules? It was my ass that was on the line." The rules that say you shouldn't destroy a ship, she explained. I didn't answer, and she chirped some sort of a translation to Xian, who listened gravely, pursed his lips, and then delivered two neat paragraphs in Mandarin. You could hear the punctuation. Mr. Xian says, said Emma, that you are a very irresponsible person. You have killed an irreplaceable piece of equipment. It was not your property. It belonged to the whole human race. He lilted a few more sentences, and she finished. We cannot make a final determination of your liability until we have further information about the condition of the ship you damaged. According to Mr. Ituno, he will have a complete check made of the ship at the first opportunity. There are two Xenotechs in transit for the new planet Aphrodite at the time of his report. They will have reached Gateway 2 by now, and we can expect their findings probably with the next outpilot. Then we will call you again. She paused, looking at me, and I took it the interview was over. Thanks a lot, I said, and pushed myself toward the door. She let me get all the way to it before she said, One more thing. Mr. Ituno's report mentions that you worked on loading and fabricating suits on Gateway 2. He authorizes a per diem payment to you, amounting to, let me see, $2,500. And your out captain, Hester Bergowitz, has authorized payment of 1% of her bonus to you for services during the return flight. So your account has been credited accordingly. I didn't have a contract with her, I said, surprised. No, but she feels you should have a share, a small share, to be sure. Altogether, she looked under a paper, it comes to $2,500 plus $5,500, $8,000 your account has been credited with. $8,000. I headed for a drop shaft, grabbed an up cable, and pondered. It was not enough to make any real difference. It certainly would not be enough to pay the damages they would soak me for messing up a ship. There wasn't enough money in the universe to pay that. If they wanted to charge me full replacement cost, there was no way to replace it. On the other hand, it was $8,000 more than I'd had. I celebrated by buying myself a drink at the Blue Hell. While I was drinking it, I thought about my options. The more I thought about them, the more they dwindled away. They would find me culpable, no doubt about that. And the least they'd assess me would be somewhere in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Well, I didn't have it. It might be a lot more, but that didn't make any difference. Once they take away all you have, there isn't anything left anyway. So when you came right down to it, my $8,000 was fairy gold. It could vanish with the morning dew. As soon as the Xenotech's report came in from Gateway 2, the board would reconvene, and that would be the end of that. So there was no particular reason to stretch my money. I might as well spend it. There was no reason either to think about getting back my old job as an ivy planter, even assuming I could get it with Shiki fired from his job as straw boss. The minute they made a judgment against me, my credit balance would disappear. So would my prepaid per capita payment. I would be subject to immediate defenestration. If there happened to be an earthbound ship in port at the time, I could just get on board, and sooner or later I would be back in Wyoming, looking for my old job at the food mines. If there wasn't a ship, then I was in trouble. I might be able to talk the American cruiser, or maybe the Brazilian one, if Francie Herrera was in a position to pull strings for me, into taking me aboard for a while until a ship showed up. Or I might not. Considered carefully, the chances were not very hopeful. The very best thing I could do would be to act before the board did, and there were two choices. I could take the next ship in port back to Earth and the food mines without waiting for the board's decision, or I could ship out again. They were two lovely choices. One of them meant giving up every chance of a decent life forever, and the other one scared me out of my mind. Mission Report. Vessel 1-103. Voyage 022-D18. Crew, G. Heron. Transit time out, 107 days, 5 hours. Note, transit time return, 103 days, 15 hours. Extract from log. At 84 days, 6 hours out, the Q instrument began to glow and there was unusual activity in the control lights. At the same time, I felt a change in the direction of thrust. For about 1 hour, there were continuing changes. Then the cue light went out and things went back to normal. Conjecture. Course change to avoid some transit hazard, perhaps a star or other body. Recommend computer search of trip logs for similar events. End mission report. Gateway was like a gentleman's club in which you never knew what members were in town. Louise Forehand was gone. Her husband, Sess, was patiently holding the fort, waiting for her or their remaining daughter to return before shipping out again himself. He helped me move back into my room, which had been temporarily occupied by three Hungarian women until they had shipped out together in a three. Moving took no great effort. I didn't own anything anymore, except what I had just bought in the commissary. The only permanent feature was Shiki Bakin, unfailingly friendly and always there. I asked him if he had heard from Clara. He had not. "Go out again, Bob," he urged. "It is the only thing to do." Yeah, I did not want to argue it. He was incontestably right. Maybe I would. I said, "I wish I weren't a coward, Shiki, but I am. I just don't know how I can make myself get into a ship again. I don't have the courage to face 100 days of fearing death every minute." He chuckled and hopped off the chest of drawers to pat my shoulder. "You don't need so much courage," he said, flapping back to the chest. "You only need courage for one day, just to get in the ship and go. Then you don't have to have courage anymore, because you don't anymore have a choice." "I think I could have done it," I said, "if Metchnikoff's theories about the color codes had been right, but some of the safe ones are dead." "It was only a statistical matter, Bob. It is true that there is a better safety record now, and a better success record, too, only marginal, yes, but better." "The ones that died are just as dead," I said. "Still, perhaps I'll talk to Dane again." Shiki looked surprised. "He's out." "When?" "Around when you left. I thought you knew." "I had forgotten. Wonder if he found the soft touch he was looking for." Shiki scratched his chin with his shoulder, keeping himself balanced with lazy wing strokes. Then he hopped off the chest and fluttered over to the Paizophone. "Let's see," he said, and punched buttons. The locator board jumped into view on the screen. "Launch 88-173, he read. "Bonus $150,000. That's not much, is it?" I thought he was going for something bigger. "Well," said Shiki, reading, "he didn't get it. Says here he came back last night." A note on black holes. Dr. Osmedian. "Now, if you start with a star bigger than 3 solar masses and it collapses, it doesn't just turn into a neutron star. It keeps on going. It gets so dense that the escape velocity exceeds 30 million centimeters a second, which is..." Question. "The speed of light?" Dr. Osmedian. "Right on, Galena. So light can't escape. So it's black. So that's why it's called a black hole. Only, if you get close enough, inside what's called the ergosphere, it isn't black. You probably could see something." Question. "What would it look like?" Dr. Osmedian. "Beats the ass off me, Jer. If anybody ever goes and sees one, he'll come back and tell us if he can. Only he probably can't. You could maybe get that close in, get your readings and come back and collect, geez, I don't know, $1 million anyway. If you could get into your lander, see, and kick the main mass of the ship away, backward, slowing it down, you might be able to give yourself enough extra velocity to get away. Not easily, but maybe if things were just right. But then, where would you go? You can't get home in a lander, and doing it the other way wouldn't work. There isn't enough mass in a lander to get you free. I see old Bob isn't enjoying this discussion, so let's move on to planetary types and dust clouds." End a note on black holes. Since Metchnikoff had halfway promised to share his expertise with me, it made sense for me to talk to him, but I wasn't feeling sensible. I got as far as checking out that he had returned without a find and with nothing to show for his efforts but the bonus, but I didn't go to see him. I didn't do much of anything, in fact. I hung around. Gateway is not the most amenity-filled place to live in the universe. But I found things to do. It beat the food mines. Each passing hour brought me an hour closer to the time when the Xenotech's report would arrive, but I managed not to think about that most of the time. I nursed drinks in the blue hell, making friends with the tourists, the visiting cruiser crews, the returnees, the new fish that kept coming up from the sweltering planets, looking, I guess, for another Clara. None showed up. I read over the letters I had written her on the trip back from Gateway 2, and then I tore them up. Instead, I wrote a simple, short note to apologize and tell her that I loved her and took it down to radio it off to her on Venus. But she wasn't there. I had forgotten how long the slow Hohmann orbits took. The locator office identified the ship she had left on easily enough. It was a right-angle orbiter which spent its whole life changing deltas to rendezvous with plane of the ecliptic flights between the planets. According to the records, her ship had made a rendezvous with a Mars-bound freighter and then a Venus-bound high-G luxury liner. She had presumably transferred to one of them, but they didn't know which, and neither one of them would reach its destination for a month or more yet. I sent duplicate copies to each ship, but there wasn't any answer. The closest I came to a new girlfriend was a gunner third from the Brazilian cruiser. Francie Herrera brought her around. "My cousin," he said, introducing us, and then privately, later, "you should know, Rob, that I do not have family feelings about my cousins." All the crews got shore leave on Gateway from time to time, and while, as I have said, Gateway wasn't Waikiki or Cairns, it beat the bare bones of a combat vessel. Susie Herrera was very young. She said she was 19 and was supposed to be at least 17 to be in the Brazilian Navy at all, but she didn't look it. She did not speak much English, but we did not need much language in common to drink at the Blue Hell. And when we went to bed, we discovered that although we had very little conversation in a verbal sense, we communicated beautifully with our bodies. But Susie was only there one day a week, and that left a great deal of time which needed destroying. I tried everything, a reinforcement group, group hugging, and working out loves and hostilities on each other. Old Hegremé's lecture series on the Hechi, a program of talks on astrophysics with a slant toward earning science bonuses from the corporation. By careful budgeting of my time, I managed to use it all up, and decision was postponed day by day. I did not want to give the impression that destroying time was a conscious plan in my mind. I was living from day to day, and each day was full. On a Thursday, Susie and Francie Herrera would check in, and the three of us might have lunch at the Blue Hell. Then Francie would go off to Rome by himself, or pick up a girl, or take a swim in Lake Superior, while Susie and I would retire to my room and my dope sticks to swim on those warmer waters of my bed. After dinner, some sort of entertainment. Thursday was the night the astrophysics lectures took place, and we would hear about the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, or red giants and dwarfs, or neutron stars, or black holes. The professor was a fat old girl grabber from some jerkwater college near Smolensk. But even through the dirty jokes, there was poetry and beauty in what he talked about. He dwelt on the old stars that gave birth to us all, spitting silicates and magnesium carbonate into space to form our planets, hydrocarbons to form ourselves. He talked about the neutron stars that bent the gravity well around them. We knew about them because two launches had killed themselves, sheared into rubble, by entering normal space too close to one of those hyperdense dwarfs. He told us about the black holes that were the places where a dense star had been, now detectable only by the observable fact that they swallowed everything nearby, even light. They had not merely bent the gravity well, they had wrapped it around themselves like a blanket. He described stars as thin as air, immense clouds of glowing gas. Told us about the pre-stars of the Orion Nebula, just now blossoming into loose knots of warm gas that might in a million years be suns. His lectures were very popular. Even old hands like Shiki and Dane Mechnikov showed up. While I listened to the professor, I could feel the wonder and beauty of space. It was too immense and glorious to be frightening, and it was not until later that I would relate those sinks of radiation and swamps of thin gas to me, to the frail, frightened, pain-sensitive creation that was the body I inhabited. And then I would think about going out among those remote titans, and my soul curled up inside me. After one of those meetings, I said goodbye to Susie and Francie and sat in an alcove near the lecture room, half hidden by the ivy, and despondently smoked a joint. Shiki found me there and halted just in front of me, supporting himself on his wings. "I was looking for you, Bob," he said, and stopped. The grass was just beginning to hit me. "Interesting lecture," I said absently, reaching for the good feeling that I wanted from the joint, and not really very interested in whether Shiki was there or not. "You missed the most interesting part," said Shiki. It occurred to me that he was looking both fearful and hopeful. There was something on his mind. I took another hit and offered him the joint. He shook his head. "Bob," he said, "I think there is something worth having coming up."
"Really?"
"Yes, really, Bob. Something quite good, and soon." I was not ready for this. I wanted to go on smoking my joint until the temporary thrill of the lecture had worn off, so that I could go back to destroying the days. The last thing I wanted was to hear about some new mission that my guilt would make me want to sign on for, and my fear would abort. Shiki caught the shelf of ivy and held himself up by it, looking at me curiously. "Bob, friend," he said, "if I can find something out for you, will you help me?"
"Help you how?"
"Take me with you," he cried. "I can do everything but go in the lander. And this mission, I think, is one where it does not so much matter. There is a bonus for everyone, even for someone who must remain in orbit."
"What are you talking about?"
The grass was hitting me now. I could feel the warmth behind my knees and the gentle blur all around me. Metchnikoff was talking to the lecturer, Shiki said. "I think from what he said that he knows of a new mission. Only, they spoke in Russian, and I did not understand very well, but it is the one he has been waiting for." I said reasonably, "The last one he went out on wasn't much, was it?"
"This is different.
I don't think he would really cut me in on anything good."
"Certainly not, if you don't ask."
"Oh, hell," I grumbled. "All right, I'll talk to him." Shiki beamed. "And then, Bob, please, take me with you." I stubbed out the joint, less than half smoked. I felt as though I wanted what was left of my wits about me. "I'll do what I can," I said, and headed back for the lecture room just as Metchnikoff was coming out. We had not spoken since he had returned. He looked as solid and broad as ever, and his fringe of chin whiskers was neatly trimmed. "Hello, Broadhead," he said suspiciously. I didn't waste words.
"I hear you've got something good coming up. Can I go along?"
He didn't waste words either.
"No."
He looked at me with frank dislike. Partly that was what I had expected from him all along, but I was pretty sure part of it was because he had heard about me and Clara. "You are going out," I persisted.
"What is it? A one?"
He stroked his whiskers. "No," he said reluctantly. "It isn't a one. It's two fives."
"Two fives?"
He stared at me suspiciously for a moment, and then almost grinned. I did not like him when he smiled. It was always a question in my mind what he was smiling about. "All right," he said. "You want in? You can have it, for all of me. It's not up to me, of course. You'll have to ask Emma. She's doing a briefing tomorrow morning, but she might let you go. It's a science mission with a minimum $1 million bonus, and you're involved."
"I'm involved?" That was something out of an unexpected direction.
"Involved how?"
"Ask Emma," he said, and brushed past me.
Letter. "Dearest father, mother, Marisa, and Pico Juan, please tell Susie's father that she is very well and is regarded with favor by her officers. You can decide for yourselves whether to tell him that she has been seeing much of my friend Rob Broadhead. He is a good man and a serious one, but he is not a fortunate one. Susie has applied for leave to go on a mission, and if the captain grants it, she speaks of going with Broadhead. We all speak of going, but as you know, we do not all do it, so perhaps it is not to be worried about. This must be very short. It is almost docking time, and I have a 48 for Gateway. With all love, Francisito." End letter. There were about a dozen prospectors in the briefing room, most of whom I knew. Seth Forehand, Shiki, Metchnikoff, and a few others I had drunk with or gone to bed with one time or another. Emma wasn't there yet, and I managed to intercept her as she was coming in. "I want to go out on this mission," I said. She looked startled.
"You do?"
I thought, but she stopped there without saying what it was she thought. I followed up. "I have as much right to go as Metchnikoff does." "You sure as hell don't have as good a record as he does, Bob." She looked me over carefully, and then she said, "Well, I'll tell you how it is, Broadhead. It's a special mission, and partly you're responsible for it. That boner of yours turns out to be interesting. I don't mean wrecking the ship. That was stupid. And if there was any justice in the universe, you'd pay for it. But dumb luck is almost as good as brains.
You got the report from Gateway 2, I guessed. She shook her head. Not yet, but it doesn't matter. We routinely programmed your mission into the computer, and it found some interesting correlations. The course pattern that took you to Gateway 2? Oh, hell, she said. Come on inside. You can sit through the briefing, at least. It'll explain everything. And then, we'll see. She took my elbow and pushed me ahead of her into the room, which was the same one we had used for a classroom. How long before? It seemed like a million years. I sat down between Sess and Shiki and waited to hear what it was she had to say. Most of you, she started off, are here by invitation, with one or two exceptions. One of the exceptions is our distinguished friend, Mr. Broadhead. He managed to wreck a ship near Gateway 2, as most of you know. By rights, we ought to throw the book at him. But before he did that, he accidentally turned up some interesting facts. His course colors were not the regular ones for Gateway 2, and when the computer compared them, it came up with a whole new concept of course setting. Apparently, only about 5 settings are critical for destination, the 5 that were the same for the usual Gateway 2 setting, and for Broadhead's new one. What the other settings mean, we don't know, but we're going to find out. She leaned back and folded her hands. This is a multiple-purpose mission, she said. We're going to do something new. For openers, we're going to send 2 ships to the same destination. Sess Forehand raised his hand. What's the point of that? Well, partly to make sure it is the same destination, we're going to vary the non-critical settings slightly, the ones we think are non-critical, and we're going to start the 2 ships 30 seconds apart. Now, if we know what we're doing, that means you'll come out about as far apart as Gateway travels in 30 seconds. Forehand wrinkled his brow. Relative to what? Good question, she nodded. Relative, we think, to the sun. The stellar motion relative to the galaxy, we think, can be neglected, at least assuming that your destination turns out to be inside the galaxy and not so far away that the galactic motion has a markedly different vector. I mean, if you came out on the opposite side, it would be 70 kilometers a second relative to the galactic center. We don't think that's involved. We only expect a relatively minor difference in velocity and direction, and, well, anyway, you should come out within somewhere between 2 and 200 kilometers of each other. Of course, she said, smiling cheerfully, that's only theoretical. Maybe the relative motions won't mean anything at all. In that case, the problem is to keep you from colliding with each other. But we're sure, pretty sure, that there will be at least some displacement. All you really need is about 15 meters, the long diameter of a 5. How sure is pretty sure? One of the girls asked. Well, Emma admitted, reasonably sure. How do we know until we try? It sounds dangerous, Sess commented. He did not seem deterred by it. He was only stating an opinion. In this, he was unlike me. I was very busy ignoring my inner sensations, trying to concentrate on the technicalities of the briefing. Emma looked surprised. That part? Look, I haven't come to the dangerous part yet. This is a non-accept destination for all 1s, most 3s, and some 5s. Why? Someone asked. That's what you're going there to find out, she said patiently. It happens to be the setting the computer picked out as best for testing the correlations between course settings. You've got armored 5s, and both accept this particular destination. That means you have what the Hichi designers figured was a good chance to handle it, right? That was a long time ago, I objected. Oh, sure. I never said otherwise. It is dangerous, at least to some extent. That's what the million is for. She stopped there, gravely considering us, until someone obliged by asking, What million? The $1 million bonus each one of you gets. When you come back, she said. They've appropriated $10 million out of corporation funds for this, equal shares. Of course, there's a good chance that it will be more than $1 million each. If you find anything worthwhile, the regular pay scales apply, and the computer thinks this is a good prospect. Why is it worth $10 million? I asked. I don't make these decisions, she said patiently. And then she looked at me as a person, not part of the group, and added, And by the way, Broadhead, we're writing off your damage to the ship, so whatever you get is yours to keep. $1 million? That's a nice little nest egg. You can go back home, buy yourself a little business, live the rest of your life on that. We looked at each other, and Emma just sat there, smiling gently and waiting. I don't know what the others were thinking about. What I was remembering was Gateway 2 and the first trip, wearing our eyes out at the instruments, looking for something that wasn't there. I suppose each of the others had washouts of their own to remember. Launch, she said at last, is day after tomorrow. The ones who want to sign, come see me in my office. A note on signatures. Dr. Asminian. So when you're looking for signs of life on a planet, you don't expect a big neon sign that says aliens live here. You look for signatures. A signature is something that shows something else is there, like your signature on a check. If I see that, I know it shows that you want it paid, so I cash it. Not yours, of course, Bob. Question. God hates a smart-ass teacher. Dr. Asminian. No offense, Bob. Methane is a typical signature. It shows the presence of warm-blooded mammals or something like them. Question. I thought methane could come from rotting vegetation and all that. Dr. Asminian. Oh, sure. But mostly it comes from the guts of large ruminants. Most of the methane in the Earth's air is cow farts. End a note on signatures. They accepted me. They turned Shiki down. But it wasn't as easy as that. Nothing ever is. The one who made sure Shiki was not going to go along was me. They filled up the first ship quickly. Cess Forehand, two girls from Sierra Leone, and a French couple, all English-speaking, all briefed, all with previous missions. For the second ship, Metchnikoff signed as crew chief right away. A gay couple, Danny A. and Danny R., were his first picks. Then, grudgingly, he agreed to me, and that left one opening. We can take your friend Bakin, Emma said, or would you prefer your other friend? What other friend? I demanded. We have an application, she said, from Gunner 3rd Susanna Herrera off the Brazilian cruiser. She has their permission to take leave for this purpose. Susie? I didn't know she'd volunteered. Emma studied her punch card reflectively. She's very well qualified, she commented. Also, she has all her parts. I am referring, she said sweetly, to her legs, of course, although, as I understand it, you have some interest in her other parts as well. Or would you care to go gay for this mission? I felt an unreasoning rush of anger. I am not one of your sexually uptight people. The thought of physical contact with a male was not frightening in itself, but with Dane Metchnikoff or one of his lovers? Gunner Herrera can be here tomorrow, Emma commented. The Brazilian cruiser is going to dock right after the orbiter. Why the hell are you asking me? I snarled. Metchnikoff's crew chief. He prefers to leave it to you, Broadhead. Which one? I don't give a damn, I yelled and left. But there's no such thing as avoiding a decision. Not making a decision was in itself decision enough to keep Shiki off the crew. If I had fought for him, they would have taken him. Without that, Susie was the obvious choice. I spent the next day staying out of Shiki's way. I picked up a new fish at the Blue Hell, fresh out of the classroom, and spent the night in her room. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.